move. I rinsed the water bowls, filled them with filtered water, hand-picked personality-appropriate saucers from a mismatched stack, and carefully measured their food. They seemed more suspicious than grateful. The cafe was empty, but the cook was unscrewing the outlet plate above my seat. I took my book into the bathroom and read while he finished. When I emerged, the cook was gone, and a woman was ready to sit in my seat. "Excuse me, this is my table." "Did you reserve it?" "Well, no, but it's my table." "Did you actually sit here? There's nothing on the table, and you have your coat on." I stood there mutely. If this were an episode of Midsummer Murder, she would surely be found strangled in a wild ravine behind an abandoned vicarage. I shrugged and sat at another table, hoping to wait her out. She spoke loudly, asking for Eggs Benedict and iced coffee with skim milk, neither offered on the menu. "She'll leave," I thought, but she didn't. She plopped her oversized red lizard bag on my table and made numerous calls on her cell phone. There was no way to escape her odious conversation, fixed on a tracking number for some missing FedEx package. I sat and stared at the heavy white coffee mug. If this were an episode of Luther, she would be found face up in the snow with the objects from her purse arranged about her, a bodily corona like Our Lady of Guadalupe. Such dark thoughts for the sake of a corner table, my inner Jiminy Cricket spoke up. "Oh, all right," I said. "May the world's small things fill her with delight." "Good, good," spoke the cricket. "And may she purchase a lottery ticket and possess the winning number." "Unnecessary, but fine." "And may she order 1,000 such bags, each more splendid than the last, delivered and dumped by FedEx, and may she be trapped by a storeroom's worth without food, water, or cell phone." "I'm leaving," said my conscience. "Me too," I said, and I went back out into the street. Delivery trucks were gridlocked on Little Bedford Street. The water department, in search of a main line, was jackhammering near Father Demos Square. I crossed over to Broadway and walked north to 25th Street to the Serbian Orthodox Cathedral dedicated to Saint Sava, the patron saint of the Serbs. I stopped, as I had many times before, to visit the bust of Nikola Tesla, the patron saint of alternating current, placed outside the church like a lone sentinel. I stood as a Con Edison truck parked within eyeshot. "No respect," I thought. "And you think you have problems," he said to me. "All currents lead to you, Mr. Tesla." "Voila, how can I serve you?" "Oh, I'm just having trouble writing. I move back and forth from lethargy to agitation." "A pity. Perhaps you should step inside and light a candle to Saint Sava. He calms the sea for ships." "Yeah, maybe. I'm off balance, not sure what's wrong." "You've misplaced joy," he said without hesitation. "Without joy, we are as dead." "How do I find it again?" "Find those who have it, and bathe in their perfection." "Thank you, Mr. Tesla. Is there something I can do for you?" "Yes," he said. "Could you move a bit toward the left? You're standing in my light." Roaming around for a few hours, looking for landmarks no longer there. Pawn shops, diners, flophouses gone. Some changes around the Flatiron building, but it is still there. I stood in awe, just as I had done in 1963, saluting its creator, Daniel Burnham. It took just a year to build his masterpiece with its triangular ground plan. Walking home, I stopped for a slice of pizza. I wondered if the triangular shape of the Flatiron building had triggered my desire for it. I got a coffee to go, which spilled over the front of my coat as the lid wasn't secured. When I entered Washington Square Park, some kid tapped me on the shoulder. I turned around and he grinned and handed me a sock. I recognized it immediately. A pale brown cotton Lazelle sock with a gilded bee embroidered by its edge. I have several pairs of such socks. But where did this one come from? I noticed his companions, two girls around 12 or 13, in a fit of laughter. It was undoubtedly yesterday's sock caught up in my pant leg that shimmied down and slid to the ground. Thanks, I mumbled and stuffed it into my pocket. Approaching the Café Dante, I could see the murals of Florence through the wide window. I wasn't ready to go home, so I went inside and ordered Egyptian chamomile tea. It arrived in a glass pot and bits of golden flowers were floating at the bottom. Blossoms covering the dead where they lie, like a line from an old murder ballad. I finally placed where the images in my morning dream might have come from. The Battle of Shiloh and the Civil War. Thousands of young soldiers lay dead on the battleground in a peach orchard in full bloom. It was said that the blossoms fell upon them, covering them like a thin layer of fragrant snow. I wondered why I had dreamed that, but then again, why do we dream about anything? I sat there for a long time drinking tea and listening to the radio. Happily, there seemed to be an actual human choosing songs with abandoned disconnect. A version of White Wedding by a Serbian hardcore punk band, then Neil Young singing, "No One Wins, It's a War of Man." Neil is right. No one wins anything. Winning is an illusion, that's for sure. The sun was going down. Where did the day go? Suddenly I remembered how Fred once found a small portable record player in the closet of a cabin we rented in northern Michigan. When he opened it up, there was a single of Radar Love on the turntable, a telepathic love song by Golden Earring that seemed to speak of our long-distance courtship and the electric thread that drew us together. It was the only record there, and we turned it up and played it over and over. A local and statewide news break, then a weather alert announced another hard rain coming. I could already feel it in my bones. The song "Your Protector" by Fleet Foxes followed. Its melancholic menace filled my heart with strange adrenaline. Time to go. I put some money down on the table and bent down to tie my bootlace, which had been dragging as I crossed through some puddles in Washington Square. "Sorry," I told my lace, wiping off traces of mud with my napkin. I noticed there was a funnel of words written on it, and I shoved it into my pocket. I would decipher it later. While I was retying my boots, the song "What a Wonderful World" came on. When I sat up, tears were welling. I leaned back in my chair and closed my eyes, trying not to listen. If you don't have one, then everyone is your Valentine. The morning's Hallmark greeting, courtesy of that darned cowpoke. I felt around for my spectacles. They were wrapped in the sheets along with the beat-up paperback of the laughing policeman and a chain with an Ethiopian cross. How does he keep reappearing, and how did he know it was Valentine's Day? I slipped into my moccasins, shuffled into the bathroom somewhat surly. Salt clung to my lashes, and the lenses of my specs were cloudy with fingerprints. I pressed a hot washcloth against my lids and glanced at the low wood bench that once served as a daybed for a young villager on the Ivory Coast. There was a small pile of white dress shirts, tattered T-shirts worn thin through the years, and Fred's old flannel shirts washed into weightlessness. I was thinking that when Fred's clothes needed mending, I did it myself. I chose one with red and black buffalo checks. It seemed a good choice. I picked my dungarees off the floor and shook out the socks. Yeah, I had no Valentine, so the cowpoke was probably right. When you don't have one, everyone is potentially your Valentine. a notion I decided to keep to myself, lest I be obliged to spend the day pasting hearts of lace on red construction paper to send out into the whole of the world. The world is everything that is the case. There is a positively elegant wisecrack, courtesy of Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico, easy to grasp, yet impossible to break down. I could print it in the center of a paper doily and deposit it into the pocket of a passing stranger. Or maybe Wittgenstein could be my valentine. We could live in a little red house in cantankerous silence on the side of a mountain in Norway. On the way to Eno, I noticed the lining of my left-hand pocket was torn and made a mental note to mend it. My mood suddenly lifted. The day was crisp and bright, the atmosphere quivering with life, like the translucent strands of a rare aquatic species with long flowing tentacles, lappets flowing vertically from a jellyfish's bell. Would that human energy could materialize in such a way. I imagine such strands waving horizontally from the edges of my black coat. There were red rosebuds in a small vase in the bathroom at Eno. I draped my coat over the empty chair across from me and then spent much of the next hour drinking coffee and filling pages of my notebook with drawings of single-celled animals and various species of plankton. It was strangely comforting, for I remember copying such things from a heavy textbook that sat on the shelf above my father's desk. He had all kinds of books rescued from dustbins and deserted houses and bought for pennies at church bazaars, the range of subjects from ufology to Plato to the planarian reflected his ever-curious mind. I would pore over this particular book for hours, contemplating its mysterious world. The dense text was impossible to penetrate, but somehow the monochromatic renderings of living organisms suggested many colors, like flashing minnows in a fluorescent pond. This obscure and nameless book, with its paramecium, algae, and amoeba, floats alive in memory, such things that disappear in time, that we find ourselves longing to see again. We search for them in close-up, as we search for our hands in a dream. My father claimed that he never remembered his dreams, but I could easily recount mine. He also told me that seeing one's own hands within a dream was exceedingly rare. I was sure I could if I set my mind to it, a notion that resulted in a plethora of failed experiments. My father questioned the usefulness of such a pursuit, but nevertheless, invading my own dreams topped my list of impossible things one must one day accomplish. In grade school, I was often scolded for not paying attention. I suppose I was busy thinking about such things, or attempting to untangle the mystery of an expanding network of seemingly unanswerable questions. The Hill of Beans equation, for example, occupied a fair portion of second grade. I was contemplating a problematic phrase in the story of Davy Crockett by Enid Meadowcroft. I wasn't supposed to be reading it, as it was in the bookcase for third graders. But drawn to it, I slipped it into my school bag and read it in secret. I instantly identified with young Davy, who was tall and gangly, telling equally tall tales, getting into scrapes, and forgetting his chores. His pa reckoned that Davy wouldn't amount to a hill of beans. I was only 7, and these words stopped me in my tracks. What could his pa have meant by that? I lay awake at night thinking about it. What was a hill of beans worth? Would a hill of anything be worth a boy like Davy Crockett? I followed my mother around the A&P pushing the shopping cart. Mommy, how much would a hill of beans cost? Oh, Patricia, I don't know. Ask your father. I'll take the cart and you go pick out your cereal and don't lag behind. I quickly did as I was told, grabbing a box of shredded wheat. Then I was off to the dry goods aisle to check the price of beans, confronted with a new dilemma. What kind of beans? Black beans, kidney beans, fava beans, lima beans, green beans, navy beans, all kinds of beans, to say nothing of baked beans, magic beans, and coffee beans. In the end, I figured Davy Crockett was far beyond measuring, even by his pa. Despite any shortcomings, he labored hard to be of use and paid off all of his father's debts. I read and reread the forbidden book, following him down paths that set my mind in unanticipated directions. If I got lost along the way, I had a compass that I had found embedded in a pile of wet leaves I was kicking my way through. The compass was old and rusted, but it still worked, connecting the earth and stars. It told me where I was standing and which way was west, but not where I was going, and nothing of my worth. Clock with no hands. In the beginning was real time. A woman enters a garden that is bursting with color. She has no memory, only a burgeoning curiosity. She approaches the man. He is not curious. He stands before a tree. Within the tree is a word that becomes a name. He receives the name of every living thing. At one with the present, he is neither ambition nor dream. The woman reaches toward him, gripped by the mystery of sensation. I closed my notebook and sat in the cafe thinking about real time. Is it time uninterrupted? Only the present comprehended? Are our thoughts nothing but passing trains, no stops, devoid of dimension, whizzing by massive posters with repeating images, catching a fragment from a window seat, yet another fragment from the next identical frame? If I write in the present yet digress, is that still real time? Real time, I reason, cannot be divided into sections like numbers on the face of a clock. If I write about the past as I simultaneously dwell in the present, am I still in real time? Perhaps there is no past or future, only the perpetual present that contains this trinity of memory. I looked out into the street and noticed the light changing. Perhaps the sun had slipped behind a cloud. Perhaps time had slipped away. Fred and I had no specific time frame. In 1979, we lived at the Book Cadillac Hotel in downtown Detroit. We lived around the clock, moving through the days and nights with little regard for time. We would stay up until dawn talking, then sleep until nightfall. When we awoke, we'd search for 24-hour diners or stop and mill around Art Fan's furniture outlet that opened at midnight and served free coffee and powdered donuts. Sometimes we'd just drive aimlessly and stop before the sun rose at some motel in a place like Port Huron or Saginaw and sleep all day. Fred loved the arcade bar that was close to our hotel. It opened in the morning, a 30-style bar with a few booths, a grill, and a large railway clock with no hands. There was no time, real or otherwise, at the arcade, and we could sit for hours with a handful of stragglers, spinning words or content within commiserating silence. Fred would have a few beers and I would drink black coffee. One such morning at the arcade bar, as he gazed at the great wall clock, Fred suddenly got an idea for a TV show. These were the early days of cable, and he envisioned broadcasting on WGPR, Detroit's pioneering black independent television station. Fred's segment, Drunk in the Afternoon, fell in the realm of the clock with no hands, unfettered by time and social expectations. It would feature one guest who would join him at the table beneath the clock, just drinking and talking. They could go as far as their mutual intoxication would take them. Fred could communicate well on any subject, from Tom Watson's golf swing to the Chicago riots to the decline of the railroad. Fred made a list of possible guests from all walks of life. On the top of his list was Cliff Robertson, a somewhat troubled B-actor who shared Fred's enthusiasm for aviation, a man close to his heart. Depending on how it was going, at unspecified intervals, I would have a 15-minute segment called Coffee Break, the idea being that Nescafe would sponsor my segment. I would not have guests, but would invite viewers to have a cup of Nescafe with me. On the other hand, Fred and his guests would not be obligated to communicate with the viewer, only with each other. I went as far as to find and purchase the perfect uniform for my segment, a gray and white pinstriped linen dress that buttoned down the front with cap sleeves in two pockets, French penitentiary style. Fred decided he would wear his khaki shirt with a dark brown tie. On coffee break, I planned to discuss prison literature, highlighting writers like Jean Genet and Albertine Sarrazin. On Drunk in the Afternoon, Fred might offer his guests some extremely fine cognac from a brown paper bag. Not all dreams need to be realized. That was what Fred used to say. We accomplished things that no one would ever know. Unexpectedly, when we returned from French Guiana, he decided to learn to fly. In 1981, we drove to the Outer Banks of North Carolina to salute America's first airfield at the Wright Brothers Memorial, taking U.S. Highway 158 to Kill Devil Hills. We then made our way along the southern coastline, moving from flight school to flight school. We journeyed through the Carolinas to Jacksonville, Florida, and on to Fernandina Beach, American Beach, Daytona Beach, then circled back to St. Augustine. There we stayed in a motel by the sea with a small kitchenette. Fred flew and drank Coca-Cola. I wrote and drank coffee. We bought miniature vials of the water discovered by Ponce de Leon, a hole in the ground gushing the supposed water of youth. "Let's never drink it," he said, and the vials became part of our trove of improbable treasure. For a time, we considered buying an abandoned lighthouse or a shrimp trawler. But when I found I was pregnant, we headed back home to Detroit, trading one set of dreams for another. Fred finally achieved his pilot's license, but couldn't afford to fly a plane. I wrote incessantly, but published nothing. Through it all, we held fast to the concept of the clock with no hands. Tasks were completed, sump pumps manned, sandbags piled, trees planted, shirts ironed, hems stitched, and yet we reserved the right to ignore the hands that kept on turning. Looking back, long after his death, our way of living seems a miracle, one that could only be achieved by the silent synchronization of the jewels and gears of a common mind. The Well. It snowed on St. Patrick's Day, causing a snag in the annual parade. I lay in bed and watched the snow swirl above the skylight. St. Patty's Day, my namesake day, as my father always said. I could hear the tones of his sonorous voice melding with the snowflakes, coaxing me to rise from my sickbed. "Come, Patricia, it's your day. The fever's past." I had spent the first months of 1954 cosseted in the atmosphere of the child convalescent. I was the only child registered in the Philadelphia area with full-blown scarlet fever. My younger siblings held somber vigilance behind my door draped in quarantine yellow. Often I would open my eyes and see the edges of their little brown shoes. Winter was passing, and I, as their leader, had not been able to go out and supervise the building of snow forts or strategize maneuvers over the homemade maps of our child wars. "Today is your day. We're going outside." It was a sunny day with mild winds. My mother laid out my clothes. Some of my hair had fallen out due to a string of high fevers, and I'd lost weight from my already lanky frame. I remember a navy blue watch cap, like the kind fishermen wore, and orange socks in respect for our Protestant grandfather. My father crouched down several feet away, encouraging me to walk. My siblings wheeled me on as I plodded unsteadily toward him. Initially weak, my strength and speed returned, and I was soon racing ahead of the neighborhood children, long-legged and free. My brother and sister and I were born in consecutive years after the end of World War II. I was the eldest, and I scripted our play, creating scenarios that they entered wholeheartedly. My brother Todd was our faithful knight. My sister Linda served as our confidant and nurse, wrapping our wounds with strips of old linens. Our cardboard shields were covered in aluminum foil and embellished with the Cross of Malta, our missions blessed by angels. We were good children, but our natural curiosity often got us into scrapes. If we were caught tangling with a rival gang or crossing a forbidden thoroughfare, our mother would place us together in one small bedroom, cautioning us not to make a single sound. We appeared to dutifully accept our sentence, but as soon as the door closed, we quickly regrouped in perfect silence. There were two small beds and a wide oak bureau with double drawers adorned with carved acorns and large knobs. We would sit in a row before the bureau, and I would whisper a code word, signaling our course. Solemnly, we would turn the knobs, entering our three-way portal to adventure. I held the lantern high, and we scurried aboard our ship, our untroubled world, as children will. Charting new splendors, we played our game of knobs, braving new enemies or revisiting moonlit forests, opening onto hallowed ground with burnished fountains and remains of castles we had come to know. We played in rapt silence until our mother released us and sent us off to sleep. It was still snowing. I had to will myself to rise. Perhaps my present malaise is akin to that childhood convalescence, which drew me to bed where I slowly recuperated, read my books, scribbled my first little stories. My malaise. It was time to draw my paper sword. Time to cut it to the ground. If my brother were still alive, he would surely press me into action. I went downstairs, eyeing rows of books, despairing of what to choose. A prima donna in the bowels of a wardrobe dripping with dresses, but with nothing to wear. How could I have nothing to read? Perhaps it wasn't a lack of a book, but a lack of obsession. I placed my hand on a familiar spine of green cloth with the gilt title, The Little Lame Prince, a favorite of mine as a child. Miss Mulock's tale of a beautiful young prince whose legs were paralyzed as an infant from a neglectful accident. He is heartlessly locked away in a solitary tower until his true fairy godmother brings him a marvelous traveling cloak that can take him anywhere he wishes. It was a difficult book to find, and I never had a copy of my own, and so I read and reread a deteriorating library copy. Then in the winter of 1993, I received an early birthday gift from my mother, along with some Christmas packages. It was to be a difficult winter. Fred was ill, and I was plagued with a vague sense of trepidation. I woke up, and it was 4 a.m. Everyone was sleeping. I tiptoed down the stairs and unwrapped the package. It was a bright 1909 edition of The Little Lame Prince. She had written, "We don't need words," on the title page in her then shaky hand. I slipped it from the shelf, opening to her inscription. Her familiar writing filled me with longing that was also comforting. "Mommy," I said aloud, and I thought of her suddenly stopping what she was doing, often in the center of the kitchen, and invoking her own mother, whom she had lost when she was 11 years old. How is it that we never completely comprehend our love for someone until they're gone? I took the book upstairs into my room and placed it with the books that had been hers. Anne of Green Gables, Daddy Long Legs, A Girl of the Limberlost. Oh, to be reborn within the pages of a book. The snow continued to fall. On impulse, I bundled up and went out to greet it. I walked east to St. Mark's Bookshop, where I roamed the aisles, randomly selecting, feeling papers and examining fonts, praying for a perfect opening line. Dispirited, I went to the M section, hoping that Henning Mankell had furthered the adventures of my favorite detective, Kurt Wallander. Sadly, I had read them all, but in lingering in the M section, I was fortuitously drawn into the interdimensional world of Haruki Murakami. I had never read Murakami. I had spent the past 2 years reading and deconstructing Bolaño's 2666, swept back to front and from every angle. Before 2666, the Master and Margarita had eclipsed all else, and before reading all of Bulgakov, there was an exhausting romance with everything Wittgenstein, including fitful attempts to break down his equation. I can't say I ever succeeded, but the process led me to a possible answer to the Mad Hatter's riddle, "Why is a raven like a writing desk?" I pictured the classroom in my country school in Germantown, Pennsylvania. We still had penmanship classes with real ink bottles and wooden dip pens with metal nibs. The raven and the writing desk? It was the ink. I am sure of it. I opened a book called A Wild Sheep Chase, chosen for its intriguing title. A phrase caught my eye. A maze of narrow streets and drainage canals. I bought it immediately. A sheep-shaped cracker to dunk in my cocoa. Then I walked to nearby Sobeya and ordered cold buckwheat noodles with yam and began to read. I was so taken by Sheep Chase that I stayed for over 2 hours, reading over a cup of sake. I could feel my blue jello funk melding at the edges. In the weeks to come, I would sit at my corner table reading nothing but Murakami. I'd come up for air just long enough to go to the bathroom or order another coffee. Dance, 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 and Kafka on the Shore swiftly followed Sheep Chase. And then, fatally, I began the Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. That was the one that did me in, setting in motion an unstoppable trajectory, like a meteor hurling toward a barren and entirely innocent sector of Earth. There are two kinds of masterpieces. There are the classic works, monstrous and divine, like Moby Dick or Wuthering Heights or Frankenstein, A Modern Prometheus. And then there is the type wherein the writer seems to infuse living energy into words as the reader is spun, wrung, and hung out to dry. Devastating books, like 2666 or The Master and Margarita. The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle is such a book. I finished it and was immediately obliged to reread it. For one thing, I did not wish to exit its atmosphere, but also the ghost of a phrase was eating at me. Something that untied a neat knot and let the frayed edges brush against my cheek as I slept. It had to do with the fate of a certain property described by Murakami in the opening chapter. The narrator is searching for his lost cat near his apartment in the Setagaya ward of the Tokyo Prefecture. He makes his way through a narrow alley, winding up at the so-called Miyawaki place, an abandoned house on an overgrown lot with a paltry bird sculpture and an obsolescent well. There is no indication that he is about to become so wrapped up that it will eclipse all else and discover within the well an entrance into a parallel world. He is just looking for his cat, but as he is drawn into the murky atmosphere of the Miyawaki place, I was as well. So much so that I could think of little else and would have gladly bribed Murakami to write me a lengthy subchapter exclusively devoted to it. Of course, it was impossible to be appeased by writing my own such chapter. It would be mere speculative fiction. Only Murakami could accurately describe every blade of grass in that wretched place. My preoccupation with the property had so completely taken me over that I became possessed with the idea to see it for myself. I carefully sifted through the last chapters for the passage. Had the phrase indicated that the property would be sold? I finally located the answer in chapter 37. Several phrases beginning with the chilling words, "We'll be getting rid of this place soon." It would indeed be sold, and the well filled and sealed. I had somehow skimmed past this fact and would have missed it entirely had it not been for a sense of something wriggling in my memory like a twist of animated string. I was somewhat shaken, for I had projected that the narrator would make it his home, becoming the guardian of the well and its portal. I had already reconciled myself to the surreptitious removal of the anonymous bird sculpture that I had grown attached to. It was suddenly gone without explanation, and nothing mentioned anywhere of its whereabouts. I've always hated loose ends, dangling phrases, unopened packages, or a character that inexplicably disappears, like a lone sheet on a clothesline before a vague storm, left a flap in the wind until that same wind carries it away to become the skin of a ghost or a child's tent. If I read a book or see a film and some seemingly insignificant thing is left unresolved, I can get remarkably unsettled, going back and forth and looking for clues or wishing I had a number to call or that I could write someone a letter. Not to complain, but just to request clarification or to answer a few questions so I can concentrate on other things. There were pigeons moving around above the skylight. I wondered what the wind-up bird looked like. I could picture the bird sculpture, stone, indistinctive, poised to fly. But I had no clue about the wind-up bird. Did it possess a tiny bird heart? A hidden spring composed of an unknown alloy? I paced about. Images of other automated birds, such as the de-switcher machine of Paul Klee and the mechanical nightingale of the Emperor of China, came to mind, but posed no insight into comprehending the key to the wind-up bird. Normally, this would have been the detail of the book that would have intrigued me, but it was overshadowed by my irrational obsession with the ill-fated Miyawaki place. So I stored away that particular rumination for another time. I sat in my bed, watching back-to-back episodes of CSI Miami, led by the stoical Horatio Caine. I momentarily nodded off, not quite asleep, neither here nor there, sliding into that mystically nauseating area in between. Perhaps I could worm my way to the outpost of the cowpoke. If I did, I would suspend sarcasm and just listen as if in answer. I saw his boots. I crouched down to see what kind of spurs he had. If they were golden, I could be sure he'd traveled far, maybe as far as China. He was swatting an extremely large horsefly. He was about to say something, I could tell. I was squatting low and saw his spurs were nickel, with a series of numbers engraved on the outer curve, which I thought may be a possible sequence for a winning lottery ticket. He yawned and stretched out his legs. "There are actually three kinds of masterpieces," was all he said. I jumped up, grabbed my black coat and copy of Wind-Up Bird, and I headed to Cafe Ino. It was later than usual, happily empty, but a handwritten sign saying out of order was taped to the coffee machine. A small blow, but I stayed anyway. I played a game of randomly opening the book, hoping to come across some allusion to the property, like choosing a card from a tarot deck that reflects your current state of mind. Then I amused myself by making lists on his blank endpapers. two kinds of masterpieces. Then I started on the third kind, as dictated by the know-it-all cowpoke. I wrote lists of possibilities, adding, subtracting, and relocating masterpieces like a mad clerk in a subterranean reading room. Lists. Small anchors in the swirl of transmitted waves, reverie and saxophone solos. A laundry lists of lists, actually retrieved in the laundry. Another in the family Bible, dated 1955. The best books I ever read. A Dog of Flanders, The Prince and the Pauper, The Blue Bird, Five Little Peppers and How They Grew. And what about Little Women, or A Tree Grows in Brooklyn? And what about Through the Looking Glass, or The Glass Bead Game? Which of them qualify for a slot in Masterpiece Column 1, 2, or 3? Which are merely beloved? And should classics be in their own column? Don't forget Lolita, the cowpoke whispered emphatically. He was now emerging out of dreamtime, a left-handed version of a numinous voice. In any event, I added Lolita, an American classic penned by a Russian, right up there with the scarlet letter. The new girl suddenly appeared at my table. Someone is coming to fix the machine. That's good. Sorry there is no coffee. That's okay, I have my table. And no people. Yeah, no people. What are you writing? I looked up at her, somewhat surprised. I had absolutely no idea. On the way home, I stopped at the deli and got a medium black coffee and a slice of hermetically sealed cornbread. It was chilly, but I didn't feel like going inside. I sat on my stoop and held my coffee in both hands until they were warm, then spent several minutes trying to unwind the saran wrap, easier to strip Lazarus. It suddenly came to me that I failed to enter an episode in the life of a landscape painter by César Eyre in the list of masterpieces. And what about a sublist of digressional masterworks such as René Dumas's A Night of Serious Drinking? It was getting all too out of hand. So much easier to write a list of what to pack for a forthcoming journey. The truth is, there is only one kind of masterpiece. A masterpiece. I shoved my list into my pocket, got up and went inside, leaving a trail of cornmeal from stoop to door. My thought processes had the destination futility of a child's locomotive. Inside, chores needed to be done. I tied up a stack of cardboard for recycling, washed the cat's water bowls, swept up their scattered dry food, then ate a tin of sardines while standing at the sink brooding over Murakami's well. The well had gone dry, but due to the miraculous opening of the portal by the narrator, it consequently brimmed with pure, sweet water. Were they really going to fill it? It was too sacred to fill up solely because it was deemed so through a single sentence in a book. In truth, the well seemed so appealing that I wanted to procure it myself and sit like a Samaritan in hope that the Messiah might return and stop for a drink. There would be absolutely no time frame involved, for armed with such a hope, one could be induced to wait forever. Unlike the narrator, I had no desire to actually enter it and go down like Alice into Murakami's wonderland. I could never conquer my aversion for enclosure or being underwater. I merely wanted to be in its proximity and be free to drink from it, for like some mad conquistador, I craved it. But how to find the Miyawaki place? Truthfully, I wasn't daunted. We are guided by roses, the scent of a page. Hadn't I traveled all the way to King's College after reading of the infamous scuffle between Karl Popper and Ludwig Wittgenstein in the book Wittgenstein's Poker? So enthralled that with a mere slip of paper scribbled with an enigmatic H3, I successfully rooted out the whereabouts of the Cambridge Moral Sciences Club. where the contentious battle between the two great philosophers occurred. Found, gained entrance, and took several oblique photographs, relatively useless to anyone save myself. I can say that it was no easy task. Some additional sleuthing sent me past a concealed farmhouse at the end of a long dirt road to the unkept grave of Wittgenstein, whose name was all but obliterated by a stippled network of mildew, algae, and lichen, appearing as if strange equations from his own hand. I suppose it could seem ludicrous to be fixated on a property some 12,000 miles away. Even more problematic, the attempt to locate a place that may or may not exist save in the mind of Murakami. I could see if I could channel his channel, or just dive into the animate mental pool and call out, "Hey, where's the bird sculpture?" Or, "What's the number of the real estate agent selling the Miyawaki place?" Or I could simply ask Murakami himself. I could find his address, or write him through his publisher. This was a unique opportunity, a living writer. So much easier than attempting to channel a 19th-century poet or an 11th-century icon painter. Yet wouldn't that be an act of out-and-out chicanery? Imagine Sherlock Holmes going to Conan Doyle for the answer to a difficult riddle instead of working it out himself. He would never deign to ask Doyle, even if a life depended on it, especially his own. No, I would not ask Murakami. Though I could attempt an aerial CAT scan of his subconscious network, or just innocently meet him for coffee where portals connect. What would the portal look like, I wondered. Several voices rang out, their answers crisscrossing one another. Like a vacant terminal at the Berlin Tempelhof Airport. Like the open circle in the roof of the Pantheon. Like the oval table in the garden of Schiller. This was interesting. Unrelated portals. Red herring or clue. I went through some boxes, certain that I had taken a few shots of the old Berlin terminal. I had no luck, but did find two pictures of the oval table in a small book of poems by Friedrich Schiller. I removed them from their glassine envelope, identical save for the sun blotting more of one shot than the other, taken from an obscure angle to emphasize its resemblance to the mouth of a baptismal font. In 2009, a few members of the CDC met in the city of Jena, in the east of Thuringia, within the wide valley of the Sale River. It was not an official meeting, more a poetic mission, at the Friedrich Schiller summer house, in the garden where he wrote Wallenstein. We were celebrating the oft-forgotten Fritz Lowe, Alfred Wegener's right-hand man. Lowe was a tall, sensitive man with slightly protruding teeth and an awkward gait. A classic scientist, with meditative fortitude, he joined Wegener for the expedition to Greenland to assist in glaciological work. In 1930, he accompanied Wegener on the grueling journey from Western Station to Eismitha, where two scientists, Ernst Sorge and Johannes Jorgi, were camped. Lowe suffered severe frostbite and could go no further than the Eismitha camp, and Wegener continued on without him. Toes on both of Lowe's feet were crudely amputated on site without anesthesia, leaving him prone in a sleeping bag for the coming months. Unaware their leader had perished, Lowe and his fellow scientists waited from November to May for his return. On Sunday evenings, Lowe would read them poems of Goethe and Schiller, filling their ice crypt with the warmth of immortality. We sat together in the grass by the oval table where Schiller and Goethe once spent hours conversing. We read a passage from Sorge's essay, Winter at Eismitha, that spoke of Lowe's stoicism and endurance, and then from a selection of the poems he had read during their terrible isolation. It was late May, and flowers were in bloom. From the distance, we could hear a lilting melody played on a concertina that we affectionately called Lowe's Song. We said our farewells, and I continued on, boarding a train to Weimar, in search of the house where Nietzsche had lived under the care of his younger sister. I taped one of the photographs of the stone table above my desk. Despite its simplicity, I thought it innately powerful, a conduit transporting me back to Jena. The table was indeed a valuable element for comprehending the concept of portal hopping. I was certain that if two dear friends laid hands upon it, like a Ouija board, it would be possible for them to be enveloped in the atmosphere of Schiller at his twilight and Goethe in his prime. All doors are open to the believer. It is the lesson of the Samaritan woman at the well. In my sleepy state, it occurred to me that if the well were a portal out, there must also be a portal in. There must be 1,001 ways to find it. I should be happy with the one. It might be possible to pass through the Orphic mirror like the drunken poet Sejest in Cocteau's Orphée. But I did not wish to pass through mirrors, nor quantum tunnel walls, or bore my way into the mind of the writer. In the end, it was Murakami himself who provided me with an unobtrusive solution. The narrator in Wind-Up Bird accomplished moving through the well into the hallway of an indefinable hotel by visualizing himself swimming, akin to his happiest moments, as Peter Pan instructed Wendy and her brothers in order to fly. Think happy thoughts. I scoured the niches of former joys, halting at a moment of secret exultation. Though it would take some time, I knew just how to do it. First, I would close my eyes and concentrate on the hands of a 10-year-old girl fingering a skate key on a cherished lace from the shoe of a 12-year-old boy. Think happy thoughts. I would simply roller skate through the portal. Wheel of Fortune. For a time I did not dream. My ball bearing somewhat rusted. I went round in waking circles, then on horizontal treks, one touchstone after another, nothing actually to touch. Not getting anywhere, I reverted to an old game, one invented long ago as an insomnia counterattack, but also useful on long bus rides as a distraction from car sickness. An interior hopscotch played in the mind, not on foot. The playing field amounted to a kind of road, a seemingly limitless but actually finite alignment of pyrite squares one must succeed in advancing in order to reach a destination of mythic resonance, say, the Alexandria Seraphim, with its entrance card attached to a tasseled velvet rope swaying from above. One proceeds by uttering an uninterrupted stream of words beginning with a chosen letter. Say, the letter M. Madrigal, minuet, master, monster, maestro, mayhem, mercy, mother, marshmallow, merengue, mastiff, mischief, marigold, mind. On and on without stopping, advancing word by word, square by square. How many times have I played this game? Always falling short of the swinging tassel, but at the worst, winding up in a dream somewhere. And so I played again. I closed my eyes, let my wrists go limp, my hands circling the keyboard of my air, then stopped and my finger pointed the way. V. Venus, Verdi, Violet, Vanessa, Villain, Vector, Valor, Vitamin, Vestige, Vortex, Vault, Vine, Virus, Vial, Vermin, Vellum, Venom, Veil. Suddenly parting as easily as a vaporous curtain, signaling the beginning of a dream. I was standing in the middle of the same cafe in its recurring dreamscape. No waitress, no coffee. I was obliged to go to the back and grind some beans and brew them myself. No one was around save the cowpoke. I noticed he had a scar like a small snake moving down his collarbone. I poured us both a steaming mug but avoided his eyes. Greek legends don't tell us anything, he was saying. Legends are stories. People interpret them or attach morals to them. Medea or the crucifixion. You can't break them down. The rain and the sun came simultaneously and begat a rainbow. Medea found Jason's eyes and she sacrificed their children. These things happen, that's all. The undeniable domino effect of being alive. He went to relieve himself while I contemplated the golden fleece according to Pasolini. I stood at the door and looked out into the horizon. The dusty scape was interrupted by rocky hills devoid of vegetation. I wondered if Medea climbed such rocks after her rage was satiated. I wondered who the cowpoke was. A kind of Homeric drifter, I supposed. I waited for him to exit the John, but he was taking too long. There were signs that things were about to shift.